Hi, Aiden. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Hi, Gabriella. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So can you just take a minute to introduce yourself to our audience, give us a little background. I'm so excited to have you on today.
Sure, yeah. So my name is Aiden. I just graduated last month from the University of Notre Dame with a major in neuroscience and minors in poverty studies and compassionate care and medicine. I'm starting medical school this fall at UPenn. So just in a little over a month, I moved to Philadelphia. I'm originally from California, so living at home with my family this summer, enjoying time with friends and everything before I get ready to head off to medical school.
That is so exciting. I'm from California too, so that's super exciting.
Yeah, enjoying the sunshine before I move to the East Coast, that's for sure.
I know. I love the East Coast. I really want to move to New York one day, so I'm sure our paths will cross, hopefully, again. I know you're so inspiring. We met at the Columbia Undergraduate Journal of Science Convention, correct, I believe?
Yes, yeah, I think we were in the same discussion group, actually.
Yeah, yeah, that was an exciting conference.
Yeah, and I really became a part of that because I'm the editor-in-chief, or I was, of the Undergraduate Science Research Journal back at Notre Dame, and it was a really cool way to bring together my interest in writing and in science. Mm-hmm. And then Columbia reached out about the conference, so I'm glad the two of us met during that.
Me too, that was really fun. I'm actually a global studies major, which is really interesting because I like to see the intersection between some of the issues that I care about. So seeing like how the International Relations Committee or community deals with issues that have to do with like water and sanitation and like the medical side of that and the correlation between the two. So that's how I ended up at the conference actually.
Yeah, and that was the best part of it too, is that yes, it was a science conference technically, but it really brought together people from all different backgrounds. So I loved having your perspective from sort of a global studies area of focus. And then there were some people that were pre-med, some people that were writers, some people that were interested in the research side of things, the policy side. So yeah, it definitely sparked some great conversation.
Definitely. So the first question I wanted to ask you that I think it's really important for maybe your listeners are wondering the same thing. How do you balance work and life responsibilities?
Yeah, this is a big question that I get a lot. And frankly, I ask myself that a lot too, is how do we seem to make everything work with, especially I think today, the orientation of students to be so hardworking and dedicated and high achieving and having these goals that people strive for a lot of times can definitely put a work-life balance in peril, or at least can pose challenges to that. I think for me, it was definitely a learning process and something that I wasn't always the greatest at and that I had to actively put effort into. And I think that's the number one lesson, is that the balance isn't going to come naturally. It has to be something that you reflect on and then actively cultivate. And one thing that I actually learned that was a big help for me, is figuring out whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. And I sort of held this previous misconception like, oh, introverts are always quiet people and extroverts are people who are loud and super outgoing. And I was thinking about myself and trying to figure out which category I fit into, because a lot of times I'm a pretty social person. I love hanging out with friends. When I am out with friends, I love to engage in conversation, and I'm usually pretty outgoing in that way. But I also enjoy my quiet time alone. And so I couldn't figure out. I was like, I think I'm an introvert, but I'm not a quiet person. So what's going on? And I actually read a book called Quiet, and that really opened my eyes to the fact that being an introvert or an extrovert is not how social you are. That's a different dimension. Introvert or extrovert is where do you get your energy from? So when I sort of figured out that piece, is that, oh, there can be social introverts and likewise there can be quiet extroverts. Yeah, exactly. Realizing that I was an introvert and that I get my energy from being alone, but that I can still go out with friends and have fun and find that balance, was something that was huge to me in realizing how I can strike that between work and life balance as well. So once it came to that point where I realized, okay, yes, I do get energy from being alone, then it came, how can I build that into my day? Because it's not something that will just magically appear hours in the day. You have to sort of look at that and think, how can you actively make this a part of your day? And so for me, it became waking up just an hour earlier in the morning to build in that quiet time for myself, that I could wake up, start my day, you know, quiet cup of coffee, write a few pages in my journal or something, just to have that quiet time built in for myself, so that then when you know, then you start engaging with your roommates or your colleagues or your fellow students or your family, you've had that time built in for yourself. Likewise, if you find out you're an extrovert and that you are energized by being with people, you can build in that time for yourself as well. So making sure you have an hour a day to just hang out with friends, spend time with people, get that energy boost from being around others. Wherever you get it from, building it in is big and helping find the balance. And then just, I think another thing besides the introvert-extrovert dimension is in general doing things that you love, and that it doesn't even feel as much like work. If you're excited to, you know, whatever research project you're working on, whatever team or group you're a part of, if you enjoy that, then it really makes the balance a lot better, because you're not forcing yourself to do certain things. You're just doing what you love, and it helps with that as well. So I think those are my two biggest pieces of advice, and the ways that I balance it is figuring out if you're an introvert or extrovert and building that time in, and then don't put your time into things if you're not truly loving what you're doing.
I love that. I totally agree. And you know, it's interesting because I'm the same way. I need to enjoy my coffee on my own sometimes and just wake up and maybe go for a walk and just enjoy that on my own, you know? So I totally agree with you. So another question that I always love asking this question because it's so important. I feel like it crafts a lot of people's stories. What has been the most significant barrier in your career, your life, school, just in general?
Yeah, this is a hard question. I had to think a little bit about it because, like you said, it sort of can shape a journey. And I think for me, at least one barrier, definitely in the career and school-wise aspect of things, was sort of having a mindset. And I think it's especially, I guess, likely to happen, like being pre-med or having a sort of set path ahead of you, but is doing things because you think you should do them, or doing things because you think you have to do them. And I'm sure it has analogs in a lot of different paths, but originally I came in to undergrad as a freshman, you know, thinking, oh, I have to do research and I have to do clinical hours and I have to do volunteering. And I wanted to do all of those and I enjoyed them. But I sort of had this checkbox mentality of what was a part of that. And so I got involved in a neuroscience research lab because I was like, oh, I'm curious about research. It's something I should do. And I want to explore and see what it's like. And to be quite honest, I didn't love it. And it took me a while, I think, to realize that that's okay to not enjoy something and to learn from that just as much as doing things that you love. So I was in it for one semester and I didn't want to quit. And I said, oh, just one more semester. And I did it again, still didn't love it, just one more semester. Did it again, still didn't love it. And he said, you know what? Why am I forcing myself to do this when I could be putting this time into something that energizes me and that I'm passionate about? And so I think that was, having that realization was huge for me, in that at that point, the following summer, after those three semesters in the research lab where I was pipetting cells and counting images on the screen on an afternoon in the basement of the biology building, I spent a summer at Mayo Clinic doing bioethics research. So I was doing interview studies and qualitative work and surveys and an entirely different type of research that did not fit my previous notion of what research was. I always thought it was white coat in a lab, but I realized there's so much more out there. And so having that realization is really what helped me break down that barrier of the old mindset. And I completely shifted the way I thought about things. And I said, you know what, I'm just gonna do what I love and what I wanna do. And if it leads to medical school, great. And if it doesn't, great. Because why would I force myself to spend the rest of my life on something that doesn't light my fire, I guess, in that way. So sort of getting out of that mindset was definitely a barrier, but one that I'm actually so glad that I learned about myself and that I have sort of oriented toward this mindset of I'm just going to do what I want to do and do what I love, and one thing will lead to another, and sort of everything happens for a reason. You're not going to, you know, look forward and say, oh, this is how things have to turn out. You just go one thing at a time and follow your curiosities and follow your excitements, and then that will help sort of pave that journey and that path.
I really like what you said about the checkbox mentality, because I'm pre-law, so I totally understand. There's so many things that everyone's like, you have to do this, you have to do this, and you have to do this, but there might be something that I don't enjoy doing, or something that, you know, I'm just unable to do at this time, and it it gives you this sense of anxiety that you're not able to do it because you're like, well, am I still going to be able to get to the point that I want to get to? And it's so crazy to think about it that there's other people out there that have felt the same way, and you know, you see the amazing places they end up. And so thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, of course. And I think that's the big thing too that you talked about, is like having this end point. It's sort of a catch-22 because you have this end goal in mind that you're striving toward, and there are some things that are important to do to help you get there and to discern whether or not that end goal is even a good fit for you. But at the same time, you don't want to do things just because you should. So it's sort of, how do you find that middle ground and make sure you're exploring all the different avenues that could lead to a profession in medicine or in law, like you said. But at the same time, just staying open and doing what you find, you know, is a really valuable use of your time and that you enjoy it and you love it. So yeah, it's definitely easier said than done, but it's an important thing to at least consider and think about.
Exactly. And like you said, you have to really enjoy what you do. So if you're not enjoying something, not everyone's journey looks the same. So mm-hmm. you don't have to do what, you know, everyone says you should be doing. You can take a different route and still end up at the end point you want to be at.
Yeah, exactly.
So another question I have for you is, who inspired you and why?
Yeah, I love this question. I have a good, I think, I guess I have different role models in different areas of my life. One of my main role models, especially in the context of this podcast, is definitely my mom. She's such a powerful woman leader, and I love her for who she is. She actually, when she always tells me about, you know, her journey and her profession, and she was in the business world, so in pharmaceutical sales, but she showed up the first day of her job. She was, you know, this 22, 23-year-old woman with a bunch of 40-year-old men, and she's like, I was the only woman in the room. And so, you know, to her, it felt so, she was like, felt a little jarred at first, and she's like, what do I do with this? What direction do I take this? But she always has this sort of just do it mentality, and she just goes for it. And that's what I love about her, and what inspires me is having that mindset of she's just going to do what it takes no matter what. And she eventually, her sales team became the top in the country at her company. And she, you know, there were certain situations that would come up. For example, she wanted to do a job share because she wanted to help raise kids. Mm-hmm. And her work told her, no, we've never done that before. That's not how we do things. And her question is always, well, why not? So she asked them that, why not? And they're like, oh, I don't know. This is just how we've always done it. And she said, well, what if I try it and I have someone who will do it with me and this is how it will work. And sure enough, they did it. So they were the first job share at the managerial level in her company. And it was because of that attitude, that just do it, why not attitude, that just because things hadn't been done that way before doesn't mean you can't try it and go for it. And she ended up being featured in Working Mother magazine, which I think is so cool.
She's
like, oh, I need to dig up that magazine and show it to you, the article. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she was a big inspiration in that way, especially with the mindset and the work ethic that she has as being a woman leader in the workplace, for sure. I guess professionally or career-wise, I definitely have a good set of people that inspire me. One that comes to mind is Nadine Burke-Harris. I don't know if you've heard of her, but she is a physician and the first Surgeon General of California. Mm-hmm. She was appointed, I think, in 2019. But she's always inspired me because her, I guess professionally, a lot of her work aligns really well with some of the things that I'm interested in and the areas that I've worked on a little bit in undergrad. But she is very big on studying and working to combat adverse childhood experiences through a super innovative way. So this is an area that really has gotten a lot of attention, I guess, in the past couple of decades, especially since a big study came out, I guess about 20 or 30 years back, about the incidence of adverse childhood experiences and defining them and what effects it can have on your brain and behavior really for the rest of your life. And so she, when she came across this body of research, her first reaction was sort of, what can she do and take action on to make a measurable impact and a difference in the community? So she actually started a clinic that was the first of its kind, a comprehensive ACE clinic that screens for these types of childhood experiences and then helps connect children to resources in the area that can sort of help to address these experiences, no matter sort of from what angle they come from. So to see that type of work happening in the community really gives me hope, especially when there's so many crazy things going on in our world now, is that there are these powerful women leaders that can do things that, you know, they see a problem and they think, how can I address this? She was a pediatrician. She did her residency at Stanford, so her clinic's up in the Bay Area. And seeing people like her is sort of my inspiration for where I hope one day I can make an impact in that realm as well.
I'm sure you will. I have no doubt in my mind. So this is another question that I know we should be asking a lot of women leaders, and that oftentimes, kind of like what you said, when it can't be done, the question we should be asking is, why not? What can we do? So how do we move forward when everyone is telling us that our idea won't work?
Yeah, this question is really interesting because I think this is especially faced, like you phrased it, when you have an idea and everyone says, oh, either we've never done things that way, or no, that's not going to happen, there's no way that could work. I think one approach that comes to mind in looking at how we move forward is seeing what the end goal is and then working backward from there. So an example that comes to mind, at least from my own experiences, is with a group called Music and Memory on Notre Dame's campus. This is actually a national organization, and there's chapters at a lot of colleges across the country. But it's a program that pairs students or volunteers or individuals with people who have dementia or Alzheimer's, usually at either local memory care facilities or nursing homes, and helps to sort of direct them through a music therapy that's personalized. And you can actually see some pretty amazing outcomes from this. There are people who can't even put together a sentence, but then will sing every single lyric to an Elvis Presley song because they still remember it. And it's, I actually took a class called Music in the Brain to learn more about how music is stored in our brains and how it's remembered and how certain areas are preserved during things like Alzheimer's or dementia. So this is a super important organization to me. I've been involved in it for a couple of years, and then the membership actually started to decline. And I got worried because I could see the tangible impact that this was having on on people with dementia in the community around South Bend and Notre Dame. And, you know, we were all sort of brainstorming as a group, what can we do to keep this going strong? And there was an existing club on campus that was called Mending Minds, and it worked with also similar things related to aging and healthy aging and things like that. And they did Music and Memory at one nursing home, but we did it at four. And so half of the leadership board was thinking, oh, we should become our own club and that way we'll get more members. But the other half, the sort of team that I was on, was thinking, instead of trying to become our own club and compete against this existing club that does something very similar, why don't we just work together with them and merge into one unit? And the other team said exactly what you had brought up, is, oh, that idea will never work. We'll be subsumed by them. We'll lose our purpose. All of these sort of, you know, approaches that they thought would happen. And because merging was sort of the more bold idea, in that it would be a lot simpler to just try to become our own club and not bother with whatever else was going on, you know, the way to move forward is, and what we sort of ended up saying is, well, let's look at the end goal. Who are we ultimately trying to serve here? And it was the nursing home constituent. You know, if it had been serving ourselves as a leadership board, it might have been really cool to have that line on our resume of, oh, we started this club and it became its own club. But ultimately, what would be best for the nursing home residents is if we merged with this existing group and work together to combine forces to continue providing the service. So I think by having that end goal orientation and looking at what you're aiming for and ultimately who are you trying to serve can help to address that question of when your idea, when people say it won't work, you say, well, what are we ultimately trying to do here? And having that approach, then we ended up merging with the other club. Our membership quadrupled. We expanded to an additional nursing home. And now it's been really exciting to see it grow, especially this past year during COVID when we couldn't go in person to the nursing home. So we ended up doing a lot of different virtual engagements. FaceTime the residents was so adorable. They had their own little iPads and we would make Spotify playlists and stream it to them. So we, and it was because we had those resources of combining with a larger established group on campus that we were able to do that. So I guess moral of the story is, when everyone's saying that an idea won't work, having that end goal mindset and then working backwards from there is a great way to push forward your idea and to gain support and to move in that direction.
You're so inspiring. I'm sitting here, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm talking to you. I know you're just going to do so many amazing things. But I'm really glad you brought that up, thinking about the end goal, because I actually, I did a program over the summer, about 2 summers ago, and it was a law school program where the professor had us, at the end of the course, he said, write down on a piece of paper why you want to be a lawyer. And so people wrote down various things, and for me, it was because I want to serve underrepresented communities. And so that's my end goal. And working backwards and seeing what can I do now to help those people? How can I get involved to get to that end goal and help those people? So I think that's very similar, and it is how we all should operate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that question too reminds me of the personal statement for medical school. It's pretty much the same question. Mm-hmm. Why do you want to go to medical school, or why do you want to go into medicine? But it's a big question, especially when it's something that, it's a goal that you're working toward. Like you said, it's an end goal, and figuring out that answer to the question is something that's important and takes a lot of reflection, and is a very meaningful thing that if, you know, you're able to figure out what that is for you and what drives you, then that could be your source of strength and motivation when the times do get hard, and when there are times that you think, oh, you know, what's the next step I should take, or how does one thing lead to another, but you remember that driving purpose, and it's a good way to keep yourself grounded.
Exactly. So moving into that, actually, the next question is, what is your why?
This question is, I really like it because I guess it sort of touches on what we were just talking about in having that moment of self-reflection and thinking what drives you and what inspires you. Someone actually told me once to figure out what you're passionate about is see what gets you talking fast. And that's something that is a pretty good signal that it's something you're excited about and something that's motivating to you. For me, I think it's actually sort of similar to you in that I also do want to hopefully engage and continue what I've done at Notre Dame, but working with, you know, individuals and populations that are marginalized, that are under-resourced, and that really need their voices to be amplified. This partly came from my poverty studies minor, and what I really loved about the minor is that it was service learning sort of oriented. So in classrooms and in the academic courses we would take, we would learn about root causes of poverty, urban poverty, education, families, all different sorts of ways that a low income can affect different areas of your life. But then at the same time, it was also an experiential minor. So we would do different engagement opportunities in the community around South Bend. I took one trip to the Appalachian region and lived on a farm for a week and learned about sustainable living. I did a seminar in Washington, D.C. called U.S. Healthcare, Poverty, and Policy, where we met with congresspeople and health policymakers and health economists and learned about things from the policy perspective. Did a seminar actually in downtown Los Angeles, so not too far from my home in Orange County, and I grew up in L.A. County too, so it was an area that hit pretty close to home, called an urban plunge, where you spent a week hearing the stories and engaging with people experiencing homelessness. And so, especially with those types of week-long trips, something that was important for me to keep in mind was that this is not me, this Notre Dame student with a poverty studies minor that thinks I know everything about people's experiences, swooping into these communities and trying to fix everything in a week. But it was actually really more to learn and to grow from people and to hear individual stories and their narratives and what shaped them and how they got to where they are. So, for me, really thinking about what my why is came through those stories and those narratives and those individual encounters. And one in particular that actually sticks with me was from when I was doing a summer service learning program. This was the summer after my freshman year, and Notre Dame has an opportunity. They have about, I think it's around 200 sites throughout the country that they'll send students for a summer. And I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, living and serving in a home with low-income patients and families, and then in the day I would go to the hospital. So in the daytime I was at the hospital, emergency department, pediatric ICU, seeing patients attached to monitors and tubes and dealing with the medications and in their hospital gown. And then it would come back in the evening, and I was in the hospitality house, And there, I would hang out with patients in our pajamas, and we would cook dinner together and talk about their day. Mm-hmm. And yes, talk about their struggles with the healthcare system, but also talk about their life outside of medicine and their kids and what they like to do for fun. And to really hear people's narratives and stories as individuals beyond what a lot of times we might see in a professional or a clinical setting was really what gave me my why. And I realized, especially from the lens of poverty studies and living in the home that I did, there's one young boy who was about 8 years old. I would play Legos with him all the time on the weekends, but I came to find out that his family had sold their home to pay for his brother's spinal surgery. So they were, you know, his mom in the evenings was filling out Habitat for Humanity forms, and his dad was having yard sales of all their old things so that they could make some money just to get by. And so I saw that situation occurring and, you know, I was hanging out with this little kid and I'm thinking, this is just a little boy. You know, when I was his age, I was thinking about my Hello Kitty birthday party. And here's this boy who, you know, when he was having his 10th birthday coming up, he was worried that he wouldn't be able to even celebrate it because he didn't have a home to go to. And it was because his family had to sell their house to pay for their healthcare. And so to me, to see that is the state that our nation is in, that in order to afford, you know, necessary medical procedures, that people need to sell their homes and then and deal with these crippling bills, is, you know, that drives me, I think, all the time about this young boy that I, you know, spent time with and hung out with. And to see the impact that that had on his family really became my driving why throughout the rest of my undergrad time. I know it will stay with me throughout the rest of my time in medical school and beyond. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and everything else that I engage with in undergrad too, I would always think back to him. So I became, you know, after coming back from that summer, a healthcare policy fellow for a congressional campaign locally in South Bend. So I worked with her to help do some policy research, track bills, look at things like Medicare for All Who Want It or prescription drug pricing reform or rural healthcare access. But with every single white paper I was writing, I was thinking about this boy, and that was my why, is that this is not a situation unique to him, but happens all across the nation. 1 in 10 people are still uninsured from a healthcare insurance perspective. And so it was really those individual stories and those encounters through my experience with the poverty studies minor at Notre Dame that became my driving force. I didn't even come in, actually, poverty studies. I was initially a minor in linguistics, and I thought I wanted to study language in the brain, which is still super cool and fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. But it was that first urban plunge in downtown Los Angeles where I just felt like I couldn't go to a school like Notre Dame, and I couldn't have these opportunities without giving back. And to me, that's just sort of how, you know, what drives my life and my goals in my career, my profession, is making the world better for people. From that sort of point of view.
I love that our whys are so similar, because I know you talked about medical bills and just kind of watching as I was growing up, having a mom who dealt with, you know, medical bills, and especially now, and seeing how expensive it is to have to, you know, get basic care.
It's ridiculous, yeah.
It is, and how the intersection between policy and medicine, and how I'll be at the policy standpoint trying to figure out how we can advocate for people who are uninsured, because unfortunately over the years it's just gotten worse and we're just trying to make it better. So that's my why is really similar too. And I know you're going to do amazing work, like I said, so I'm really excited to see that.
Well, in healthcare in our nation, I go on about it forever. It's barely really a system even. It's pretty piecemeal. Yeah. And there's a lot of ongoing debates too about, is it the prices that drives our spending so high? Is it the utilization? Is it a combination of the two? And it's definitely something, like you said, that there's sort of this interface of clinical medicine and clinical practice, but also policy. And I think physicians and clinicians are becoming increasingly aware of the fact that we can't remain silent on this, and that our patients' health is a lot more than just the medications that we prescribe them, but the social and the structural and the political conditions in which they live and they exist, and their access to a park and their ability to take time off of work to exercise, or their ability to be able to afford healthy food to cook for their kids. you know, there's reasons that diabetes affect low-income communities at higher rates and other chronic conditions. So it's definitely something that drives me and motivates me is that intersection of the two. I'm actually considering law school as well. I took the LSAT this semester and pre-applied into a dual MD-JD program. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about that, or maybe a master's in public policy, or maybe even a PhD in some sort of health economics and policy. So just trying to stay open and explore, but like you said, letting that why drive me.
Yeah, exactly. So my last question is, what is one thing you wish more people knew about women, in like the workplace or in school or life in general?
Yeah, I think one thing that I wish people knew about women in the workplace is maybe the value of mentorship. And I think that this is something that a lot of times becomes very cliched is, oh, find mentors. But it's something that I think is really sort of vague on how do you do that? What does it mean to have a mentor, to find a mentor? And it actually comes, the word mentor, from the Odyssey in Greek, and his mentor, that was his name, but it means teacher or guide. And so really cultivating those relationships is important, and it's something that can definitely, especially as women in the workplace, be an asset, is by having mentors at different stages along your career and people that inspire you. This is a value then that you can sort of turn and give back to others. And so I think this is especially pertinent in, you know, thinking about how different women in the workplace can bring assets to their experiences. And you know, for me at first I was like, oh, how do I find a mentor? What does that even mean? And a lot of times there will be structured programs to do so, which is a great first start. And then another thing that I found was really helpful is just looking ahead and seeing who's doing what I want to be doing, and then just reach out to them and, mm-hmm. you know, cold email them and just say, can we grab coffee or can we chat for 30 minutes over the mm-hmm. phone? And really 8 or 9 times out of 10, they'll say sure, and they'll be happy and excited that you reached out. And especially I think for me, having women mentors was important too, because a lot of historically in medicine, especially looking at higher up leadership, things like medical school deans or directors of different centers, historically has not been women dominated. And so when we're trying to push for equity and equality in the workplace or in any other field, I think having mentors and learning from them, and even things like this podcast and actively opening up a conversation about these types of things, is what can really push the needle forward in areas of advancing not only women in the workplace, but just people of all different backgrounds and you know, gender, race, ethnicity. I think diversity is so important in that it brings different backgrounds and different perspectives together, and things that you may not have thought of or come up with on your own. But because of that diversity, it can really advance new ideas even in that way as well.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I'm extremely inspired, and I know our listeners will be too. It was such a great way to connect with you and to have a conversation with you. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's so excited. I can't wait already to tune into the next episode. So I'm really glad that you're pushing forward this initiative.
Thank you so much.